Chapter 2. Fighting the Tide. The sea thrashed, and the wind howled past Cyrus Hinterdale as he stood staring out into the approaching storm. His bare feet sank slightly into the thick-packed, muddy sand left by the receding tide. Cyrus had adopted the natives' custom of going about with no shirt in the tropical climate of Dinku Appa, a remote equatorial isle that, for now at least, was his home. Cyrus had seen many a storm, safe on dry land and huddled indoors in his homeland of Acardia. His thick northern blood was not so bothered by the cooler air this southern storm blew. In fact, it seemed a refreshing change from the often sweltering heat of the daylight hours of summertime on the island. If not for the steel-gray sky with its otherworldly look to it, the wind-blown rain trying to drive itself beneath his skin like a storm of nails, and the threat of the storm surge washing out the low-lying village, the day might almost have been pleasant. Toktu, senior elder among the Dinku, had told Cyrus that this storm did not look so bad as many of the islanders had seen. Nonetheless, most of the Dinku had retreated to more sheltered ground, taking refuge in some caves farther inland. Those who had remained behind wished to see a unique sight. Their spirit man wanted to hold back the storm. Cyrus had been using shielding spells as exercise for his source. He had only learned of magic's existence a few months ago and was trying to make up for a youth of lost opportunity. In the realm of Kadrin, which Cyrus saw through the eyes of his counterpart from the other world, his twin, Brannis, each night instead of dreaming, a sorcerer would be trained from an early age, starting as young as 8 or so with formal training. Cyrus had seen all the rudiments as Brannis had struggled through the early ranks of the Kadrin Imperial Academy of Sorcery, before they finally gave up on ever making a sorcerer of him, despite his family's strong magical heritage. It seemed as if, joined by some mystical connection, their sources were the inverse of one another. Brannis was a stone, almost entirely cut off from the ether. Cyrus found that it leapt to his call and flowed from his source like a river. For weeks, Cyrus had been wading out into the shallow waters near the tide line and practicing holding back the sea. At first, he had just tried stopping the lapping kiss of water that would tickle the toes of walkers along the beach. It amused him at first to see the water stop weirdly at an invisible barrier and crash lightly against it, as if he had fashioned a glass so clear it did not cast any distortion or glare to betray its presence. With practice, he was able to form his shield farther and farther out into the tide. He kept the shield arced so that the vast and cunning Katamic Sea did not simply sneak around the sides, and he stood close enough to the center of that arc, as it seemed easiest to keep an equal pressure of ether in all directions that way. With the coming of the storm, Cyrus found both a test and a purpose. The Dinku had taken him in when the notorious pirate Denric Zane had stranded him on their island after expressing concern about potential retribution in this world for the attack of Denric's own twin on Brannis's homeland in the other. Cyrus had shared their food, lived in one of their homes, and had begun to learn their language. In return, he had been able to do nothing of use for them, save entertain with his magical tricks. Now, though, with talk of storm surges that might wash away part of the village, Cyrus intended to keep his new home safe from the storm.
"He is brave, our spirit man," Tipu commented, crouched behind a palm tree in an effort to shield herself from the worst of the storm winds. Her green-dyed hair was being played havoc by the storm winds. Clad in just a loincloth and a pair of necklaces, the latter doing little to either cover or protect her, she shivered against the cool, wet air that tore past her.
"Yes, very," agreed Kali, her long, scarlet-dyed braids whipping behind her as the wind gusted.
She huddled against Tipu's back, both for warmth and the shelter of the wind.
"And look, he does not even shake with cold. He is a northerner. Their winds are always cold. He sweats like a hunter even on mild days," said Gahalu, Cyrus's best friend among the Dinku.
While the two girls had claimed Cyrus as their own, and had been trying, with limited results, to woo him. Gahalu had been Kairos's interpreter and guide on the island. Worldly by Denku standards, Gahalu had sailed aboard foreign ships, learned about distant lands, and picked up a few exotic languages, Kairos's among them.
"This weather probably reminds him of home," Gahalu said. "This is home now for him," Kali insisted. "Look how he risks his life to defend it."
She pointed to the bare-chested northerner, standing where the water ought to have been chest-deep, with the seawater stopping eerily a few paces from him at well over head height.
"You said he was not spirit man among his own people, that they chased him off and wished to kill him. That does not sound like home. Home is where he is loved. Home is where he will have strong sons who will grow up to be hunters and elders and spirit men," Tipu said.
Despite his scrawny body and skin that refused to darken to the creamy bronze color the Denku felt looked healthiest, Kairos was an object of desire and envy among the Denku women. Tipu and Kali had gotten to him first and claimed him, but should he decide to send them away, others would be quick to fill their places. Gahalu sighed and watched his friend fighting the Katamic. Kairos spoke more to Gahalu than anyone else, even though he was picking up the Denku language quite quickly. He knew that Kairos had other reasons for damming the tide, though he had no cause to think the lad was being less than selfless in this particular instance. It allowed him to strengthen his powers with the spirit world, and Gahalu knew why that was important to Kairos. Kairos had explained that, with enough power, he could make himself disappear from Denku Appa and appear in his homeland of Acardia. There was a girl there, in Scar Harbor, that he missed very much, and he wished to return to her. He was too polite to shun Tipu and Kali, and was smart enough to know that if he did, more would come after him. But he did not want them. Surely he had fallen prey to their charms. The two girls were not shy at all about their victories when speaking to the other Denku women, but he always seemed shamed by it after. The Scar Harbor girl was like a shark, Gahalu thought. She had sunk her teeth into Kairos, and he was not able to swim free of her. Gahalu found himself thinking like the elder that his gray hairs said he was becoming, meddling in the loves of the young. For all their inane chatter, he wished the two girls well in their quest to win Kairos's heart. He did not want to see his friend go.
"I had expected this to be harder," Kairos thought. He was holding back a wall of water 10 feet high and hundreds of feet long. He had struggled at first to get the wall shaped properly. It had to be wider than usual, and therefore could not be as far out to sea as he would have liked. He had abandoned his usual tactic of standing at the center of the arced wall, and instead stood close to it. With how long the wall needed to be to protect the village, to center it at the water's edge would have pushed it so far out that it would have to be thrice the height and bear a much greater weight of water. As it was, Kairos was hardly noticing the effort now that he had it stable.
Either in, either out.
Kairos was drawing a small, constant flow of ether to keep up the spell. Ether was fortunately a resource in abundance on the island. Many of the native species produced admirable amounts of the stuff, and the sea life inhabited the area in such vast numbers that the supply seemed inexhaustible. With few sorcerers in his own world, the ether seemed to be all his for the taking. In his counterpart's world, sorcerers were common enough that such vast seas of ether were unheard of. Kairos knew that he ought to have felt like a mighty wizard of the fairy stories, but he knew the trick now. It was still wondrous, but he suspected that any sorcerer from Kadrin brought into his world would be able to manage much the same with the ready supply of ether at hand. More than that, though, with the more challenging effort of creating and stabilizing the wall now past, it was growing boring. Storms were not momentary things by and large, and this one had already been raging for hours. His feet were aching, and his back was growing sore from standing so long in one place. Kairos knew that he could sit down in the mud, or even recline, and still hold the wall intact just as well. He also knew that there were a dozen or more Denku who had trusted him enough to come out as close as the tree line to watch. Among them were all his closest friends on the island, as well as Tipu and Kali. As much as their advances exasperated him, he did not wish to diminish himself in their eyes. A primal, primitive part of his brain insisted that the affection of pretty girls was important, and not to be jeopardized by sore feet or boredom. Kairos took his midday meal at his post, holding back the storm sea. He had grown accustomed enough to the light work of holding the ether-formed wall in place that he felt safe performing other magics while he held it. He had chosen from among the multitudes of fish arrayed before him like a child's fishbowl, and plucked the source from a tasty-looking specimen. Flat and tall, the green and yellow striped fish was shaped like the paddles the Denku used for their fishing boats, and as long as Kairos's forearm. Gone limp as its life's essence was cleanly removed, the fish offered no resistance as Kairos then levitated it over the invisible wall and into his waiting hands, frying it with ether as it floated the short distance through the air. Kairos kept a small knife at his belt, made of steel. It was a valuable gift from his Denku hosts, and used it to fillet the fish. He ate as he worked, never taking his eye long from the real task at hand as he continued to hold back a mind-boggling amount of seawater. When he'd had his fill, he threw what remained of his meal over the wall and back into the Katamic for other predators to finish off. When the ache of his feet finally got the better of him, he quietly cast a levitation spell, just using it to lift himself up such that his heels barely brushed the muddy ground. "I wonder if this means I'm beginning to think like a sorcerer, when levitation magic seems like the proper course of action, rather than sitting down and getting my trousers muddy." When the storm finally calmed, and the risk to the village had passed, Kairos released the shielding spell. He was worn inside and out. It was the longest he had ever used his source, certainly, and as best he could recall, the longest he had ever stood in one place. With the storm clouds obscuring the sun all day, Kairos could only guess how long he had kept up the wall, but he figured 6 hours at least. "Should anyone ever inquire about it one day, that is what I shall tell them anyway." The overcast sky allowed occasional breaks that let in the light of the late afternoon. Kairos just had no idea how early it had been when the storm began, having awakened to a deep gray ceiling of the world. The freed surf washed around Kairos's ankles as he turned back toward the village and saw his audience rush down to meet him, finally feeling safe with the spirit man's strange magic no longer in effect. Too many of them talked at once for Kairos to pick out more than a stray word here or there in the Denku tongue, which he only understood at a modest pace. When Tipu and Kali saw him fatigued and came to support him under each arm, he at least tried to focus on what they were saying to him, since he suspected it would have the most immediate bearing on his evening.
"We will help to house. I, you."
There were too many words Kairos was unfamiliar with, and they were both speaking too fast for him to separate the words and decipher them. He gathered that they were intent on helping him back to the little house he had been given, but beyond that, it was all gibberish to him. When Tipu took her long necklaces and slung them over his head as well as hers, he began to suspect that rest was not on his agenda for the evening. "Hungry," Kairos managed in Denku, one of the words he had made sure Gahalu taught him. "Sleepy." Kali seemed to understand the former at least, and rubbed his stomach, nodding eagerly.
"Hopefully with a full belly and a worn-out brain, I can fall asleep right after dinner."
Gahalu stayed back from his friend as the crowd, and Kairos's two amorous pursuers, escorted Kairos back to the village. The Denku had much wisdom about the sea, but their people did not make up catchy little sayings the way so many foreigners did, to help make them easy to convey. Thus it was a Feru Maru saying that stuck in Gahalu's mind as he looked at Spirit Man Kairos. "No man can stop the tides." Kairos just had. and stopped a storm atop it. The young Akkadian was seeking to increase his magical power so he could use it to return to his home. After what he had just witnessed, Gahalu did not expect it would be long before Kairos would try to use his powers to leave them. Kairos lay awake on his sleeping mat, unable to still his mind. Kali curled against him, under one arm, and Tipu the other, slumbering softly. The bedding in the small stone house that some previous mainlander had built on Dinku Appa had been lumpy and uncomfortable, so Kairos had adopted the Dinku custom of sleeping on the ground. His own head rested on a pillow made from a sand-filled sack, which formed a cradle shaped for the size of his head by many nights' experience. His two companions pillowed their heads on his chest. He felt badly for having used magic on the girls to lull them to sleep, but it was easier than arguing with them and kinder than spurning them. He owed Brannis a debt for having learned a sleeping spell for him to defend himself with. Even with the spell, the two of them still found alertness enough before drifting off that they had latched onto him. Kairos wore ruts in his mind with his mental pacing, wondering what to do with Tipu and Kali. He could not sum them up on a ledger like some merchant, though he had tried. He did not dislike either of them, far from it. They were sweet and thoughtful, unfailingly attentive, and, he reluctantly admitted, alluring. They were cousins, he had discovered, but were as close as sisters, and had always planned to share some hunter together. They never quarreled with one another, at least with Kairos around. They just seemed so young. Kairos was a young man himself, just 22 years old, and he would have been surprised if his two suitors were much younger, at least in years. Kairos drew a distinction between young and youthful. The latter bespoke vigor, energy, and a brightness of spirit. The former indicated naivete, over-exuberance, and a stubbornness born of a refusal to accept unpleasant truths. For all the times they were not trying to busy themselves with the bits he kept beneath his trousers, they seemed like young girls, playful and cheerful, irresponsible and oblivious to all that went on outside the focus of their vision. He would have liked to consider himself something of a philosopher for seeing the difference, but he knew he was splitting hairs in trying to indict the girls for traits he found himself drawn to in Abelay. Abelay Tillman was somewhere back in Scar Harbor, the only girl Kairos had ever fallen in love with. He loved the joy she took in the simple things in life, like the break of the sea against Acardia's rocky shores, or the sights and smells of the markets when foreign traders came to town. She had little money and only a brother to call family, yet she did not let the cares of the world burden her. She carried on with a smile, and was always considerate of others ahead of herself. That was probably the key difference, as Kairos saw it. As much as Tipu and Kali doted on him, it was a greedy sort of love they showered on him. They wanted him for themselves, to be the spirit man's wives, to be the envy of the other girls from the village, to have their children possibly become spirit men one day themselves. Thus he longed for Abelay, who fell in love with him when he was a simple scrivener, whose only claim to wealth was an old shop he had been given by his former employer as a gift. Kairos had paid a pittance for it, for appearance's sake, but knew it for the gift that it was. He was resolved to return to Scar Harbor, outlaw or not, and marry her. They might have to live on the run. He hoped she would be willing to go, and there would be other complications to be sure, but they were not insurmountable, not with the magic he was learning. Kairos sighed, staring up at the ceiling of his little house as the sky outside gave way to the dark of night. The storm-churned Katamic stank of things normally buried deep under the water, and belched forth a cold, brackish wind. Kairos was not bothered by the rank air that the sea coughed up, for the fragrance of Tipu and Kali's hair dyes filled his nostrils with scents of melon and spice. The unseasonable chill of the night's winds blew in through the straw-covered doorway, but Kairos did not mind. The two Dinku girls pressed tight against him for warmth, and the heat from their bare skin warmed Kairos as well. "I have never even held Abelay this close," Kairos mused. "I think that is why they bother me at times.
they take liberties I had thought to have reserved just for her.
I will make amends. I have grown stronger, and soon enough, I will rip a path through the ether and step through it, leaving Denku Appa and arriving back home, if only for long enough to reclaim Abelay. I wonder if she would like it here.
Kairos thought his last thought before sleep claimed him, picturing Abelay clad in Denku fashion, curled at his side instead of Tipu. He met slumber that night with a smile on his face.